All right, Mark chapter 15 is where we are at. I believe we're in around verse 3, but we'll start in verse 1 so we can get a running start. Jesus has finally made it before Pontius Pilate. Peter has already disowned him after the Sanhedrin found Jesus guilty because of him claiming to be Christ, to be king and priest, as well as of blasphemy. But they can't bring that accusation against Jesus before the Roman Empire and have them actually accomplish what they want to accomplish, that is to kill Jesus. As a result, the time they bring him before Pontius Pilate, they're going to be bringing different accusations before him. Specifically, Jesus is claiming to be king of the Jews. Chapter 15, verse 1. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "Yes, it is, as you say." Although we talked about last class how the Greek is a little bit less emphatic than what the English is here. The English sounds like Jesus emphatically says, "Yes, it is, as you say." Where the Greek's more along the lines of, "Yeah, whatever you say. If you say so, whatever, that's fine." He's given an ambiguous answer to a ridiculous question. "Are you king of the Jews? Have you been around? Have you been seeing what I've been doing? Have you heard the stuff that's going on?" "No." "Okay, well, whatever you say then. That's fine." The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, aren't you going to answer? See how many things they were accusing you of? But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. We talked about this some yesterday, but why would Pilate be amazed? Because of the honor-shame game. What in particular? That's exactly right. Yeah, that a silence is an answer. But what amazes him about this silence? What is shocking to Pilate? Yeah, maybe he just doesn't understand why it is that Jesus isn't coming out and just defending himself and arguing his way into innocence. I think it's also shocking to him because of who's bringing the accusations against him. Jesus not speaking. Pilate gets the understanding that it's not because he doesn't have anything to say, but it's because he doesn't feel like the people are worthy of him talking. And the people that have brought before him, you're talking the chief priests, the elders and teachers of the law, the whole Sanhedrin are bringing these before him. Jesus is going, just not worth my time. The honor status is just too far different here. Pilate is amazed. "Aren't you going to say anything?" "No, I'm good." Pilate's amazed because Jesus says nothing. Verse 6, "Now it was the custom at the feast to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising." All right, really quick here, Barabbas. Who is he? I don't know. We don't really know much about him outside of the mentioning of him in the Gospels. We really don't. We can deduce a couple of different things. It is possible that the etymology of his name, Barabbas, would be what? Split it apart. Son of what? Abba. It's possible that what it just means is son of a father, son of a dad, a daddy, something quite generic. Now, why would you have that name as an insurrectionist? You know what I mean? If you're an insurrectionist, you're going to be called Nails or something. You know what I mean? Or the Punisher. But then we have the son of a guy, son of a dad, son of a father. Why would you have that name? Just because that was the nickname that your friends gave you. It's kind of the unfortunate gang name that you got as you were coming up in the political insurrectionist groups.
Kind of like not have a father, you know, like he doesn't know who his dad is or something like that. Like,
maybe it's driven because he doesn't know who his dad is. Possibly. You're on the right track. Maybe it's not because Barabbas doesn't know who his dad is. Maybe it's because as an insurrectionist, he wants to protect everyone that's close to him at all. So he says, it's almost kind of like you become identityless so that you can accomplish a lot more. Because remember, a lot of them, their names would be you know, James, son of or Bar Zebedee. And so they go back and they go Zebedee, or they would say, you know, Jesus of Nazareth. Identifying markers, either location or father's names, so that they could identify who this person was. But if you come in and your name is son of a guy, they don't really know who you are. They don't know who you're connected to. They don't know anything about you. And it's hard for them to have any sort of political leverage against you. So if he makes his name more generic, it's possible he can accomplish a lot more in his political revolution. Is that making sense? So you have Barabbas, the son of a dad, a guy, which is quite ironic. Because in Mark chapter 14, Jesus reveals himself to be the son of an Abba as well, does he not? So you have son of an Abba, son of Abba. Both standing there, and Pilate wanting to release one of them. The other thing that's quite significant about Barabbas is the fact that his rap sheet is somewhat given for us. This text is pretty clear about Barabbas. He is a murderer. He is a violent political insurrectionist. Even the word that is beyond laestes, that's more strong for insurrectionist, is used here. He is an insurrectionist. He is a murderer, a killer in an uprising. So you have two people that can be set free. A convicted murderer, the son of some Abba, or the son of Abba that has a nonviolent kingdom that really can't be condemned of anything according to the Roman Empire. I think this was somewhat of a political ploy because Pilate, as well as the people he's offering Jesus to, or he's offering Jesus and Barabbas to, they know who truly is guilty in this moment. We'll even see in a minute that Pilate even does this, initiates this, because he suspects it's more political posturing of the Jewish elite than it is trying to convict a guilty man. But you have Barabbas, who is offered. A man called Barabbas, verse 7, was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing when it was out of envy that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him anyway. Pilate's not an idiot. He knows what's happening here. Why? Because Pilate's a good politician. Pilate knows what he would have done. You politically posture yourself in a way that brings yourself advantages. The truth doesn't really matter. It's one of the reasons why in John chapter, 19, whenever Pilate is talking with Jesus, and all of a sudden Pilate says, "What is the truth?" It's not because he's the first, you know, the ridiculous philosophical phrase that's thrown on people that doesn't make much sense. Starts with an R. I can't remember it now. He's not the first one to say, there's truth for everyone. There's just truth for everyone. What is it? Yeah, relativist. There we go. I think that word has about as much... Never mind, I won't get into that. We can talk philosophy some other time. It's not that he's the first relativist that comes on the scene. It's that, honestly, the question of what is the truth in politics is a lot more complicated answer than what we like to make it. Because for Pilate, the truth, or what is right, isn't always just what the evidence of the case is bringing towards him. It's what can politically posture himself for advancement. And that will declare, or that will navigate, what truth is that he lands on. But Pilate knows the game they're playing. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing it was out of envy that the chief priest had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. Whoops. "What shall I do then with the one you call king of the Jews?" Notice the emphasis. "What should I do with the one that you call king of the Jews? He's your king." Where would he be getting that idea? Where do they call him king of the Jews? Did they ever call him king of the Jews? Did they ever herald Jesus a king? Yeah, the crowd is the ones calling for Barabbas right now. The same crowds, probably at least some overlap of the same people, that were chanting Hosanna, for the King of David is coming in and we will be victorious, singing Psalm 118 at the triumphal entry, laying down their palm branches and their cloaks, saying, it doesn't matter what happens, we'll lay down our lives for you. And now that same crowd is chanting, give us Barabbas. He says, no, wait a minute, what do you want me to do with the one that you called King of the Jews? You heralded him as that. Did you ever do that for Barabbas? Then why do you want him and not your king? Pilate asks. Good question. Verse 13, their response. Instead of giving him an answer, they just begin to scream, crucify him. The chant has shifted. For they were chanting, Hosanna. And now they're chanting, crucify him. Man, when you're playing for the crowds, you realize how fickle the crowds really are. This is just a ministry principle. There is a big part of me, I'm actually coming to terms with this more and more I get older. I never thought this about myself, but it's something that is true, and I need to just come to terms with it. There's a part of me that is a people pleaser. And I know that's, many of you may not know me, so that may not be weird for you. My wife would say, I guess. that's a whole other issue. But the more and more I realize that if my motivation and what I'm doing or how I'm doing it is to please a crowd, pretty soon that crowd that I'm trying to please will be chanting something totally different than what they were 10 minutes earlier. You just can't do things motivated to please a crowd. You just can't. Because whether it is that, you know, you're just not the flavor of the day anymore, or whether it is because you have to compromise truth at some point, crowds will always turn on you. And that just can never be your motivation. And I'm not saying so then you do things just to tick the crowd off. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is what needs to motivate what you're doing, what guides what you're doing, has to be that which is beyond not only the crowds but all of creation. You've got to be motivated by the desire to hear, job well done, my good and faithful servant. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, I struggle with having tough conversations on issues that don't make me feel comfortable, like we had last Friday with Taylor and all of us. I don't like those conversations. Because I love you guys, and I would appreciate it if you guys loved me, but I understand you may not. All that to say, you cannot do things to have the crowd just love you. You just can't do that. Because one day they won't. Or they will ask you to do something that with all that is in you, you know you have to compromise everything that you are. You just can't trust the crowd. You've got to, with all that is in you, you've got to just trust the truth that God's asking you to bring and to be. And that can get the crowd to either be chanting Hosanna, our Savior has come, or it can get them to start screaming, crucify him. And you'll hear them both from the same crowd in the same ministry. And when you do, just know you're in good company. The same thing happened to Jesus in Jerusalem. Within a week, they changed their chant. Crucify him, they now scream. Verse 14, good question, Pilate. Why? You see, this is something we are wrestling with in Christology. I don't think it's because Pilate thinks Jesus is innocent of absolutely everything. Because claiming to be a king of a kingdom was threatening towards Rome. But it didn't necessarily deserve immediate execution or capital punishment. It needed to be dealt with, but in the right way. As a Roman politician, Pilate had to make sure that he used enough force to get the point across, but not excessive force to the point where the people will once again riot. Remember, Pilate's interaction with the Jews thus far has not been complicit or blissful. He's had a bit of a bumpy start, and usually all tyrants, all political rulers, especially in Judea, come in with an iron fist. And they push so hard that eventually the whole people will revolt unless they pull back. Pilate pushed a little too hard up front with his attempt at trying to get the Caesar's images put inside of the temple. Matter of fact, there's even another story of Pilate antagonizing the Samaritans, where he tells them that they found some artifacts that would validate that they were the true people of God at the base of one of their holy mountains. And he gets them all there, and once they're all there, he has just a ton of them slaughtered. That's Pilate. He's not a nice guy. But he understands that you can't just go around capital punishing anybody the crowds bring to you. He does believe Jesus is guilty of something, but not enough to be killed or crucified. That's reserved for specific people doing specific things, kind of like Barabbas. So he says, why? Why crucify him? I'm not saying don't punish him. I'm just saying, what's he guilty that deserves capital punishment? What is he really guilty of that deserves me to hang him on a cross for the next 2 to 3 days, which is usually how long crucifixions took, although Jesus says it will only take a matter of hours. What crime has he committed, verse 14, asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder. They don't answer his question for a second time. They don't care about the truth. They don't care about giving the right answers. They care about just using what their key area of influence is, and that is, we are a crowd and we want something. And if you don't do it, we'll come after you too. So they scream all the louder, crucify him. Verse 15, this is the problem. Wanting to satisfy the crowd. See the problem? What is the truth? Pilate's going, the truth's a lot more complicated than just what is right and wrong. So if I was basing this off what right and wrong, I could not kill Jesus. Because he's not done anything that deserves capital punishment. When you're a politician, sometimes the way that you have to make your decision sometimes is by simply doing this. You just, which way is the wind blowing? Oh, okay, then we'll go that way. That's why in a book called God's Politics by a guy named Jim Wallace, he says if the church really wants to impact politics, you need to change the way in which the wind is blowing. If you change the wind, politicians will follow. Don't try to change politicians. Change the wind. And that's what Pilate shows us right here. Wanting to please the crowds. Because his political security depends upon the ways in which the crowds interact with him. Wanting to satisfy the crowd. And, it's also one of the reasons why this time of year the political climate starts to just really make me just sick to my stomach. Because man, especially in the primaries, you'll hear people flip-flopping, doing whatever they can just to get the crowds pleased. They just, both sides. Don't act like it's just one side or the other. Both sides. They're just trying to figure out which way the wind is blowing and which can get them the most votes. Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them, a convicted murderer of a political insurrection. He released them to them. It's pretty interesting because in this moment, the crowds really have an option. The political lens of the kingdom that the Jews have been governed by ad nauseum, that is the violent kingdom represented by Barabbas, they have an option. Or the nonviolent kingdom that Jesus has been bringing and talking about this whole time. They have an option. And which do they choose? Which do they choose? They say, this is just who we are. This is who we are. This is the kingdom we're fighting for. We side with Barabbas. They get their choice, or they get their wish. Pilate released Barabbas to them, and he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium. Why? Because what happens inside the praetorium stays in the praetorium. Get him back there, you can pretty much do whatever you want. And they called together the whole company of soldiers. This probably would have been anywhere from 400 to 1,000 soldiers. Why? Why would they call together the whole soldiers? Because Jesus is that frightening? They're so afraid of Jesus that they have to bring all the soldiers they have there? No! Don't think of it as they're afraid of something. Think of them as them celebrating something. This is a party. So bring all the soldiers. This is a morale booster. Let's beat the guy that the Jews claim to be as their king. Let's just have some fun. Make a human pinata out of the one that these filthy, annoying, ignorant Jews claim as their king. And let's show him and them who really rules this world. So get all the soldiers together. Verse 17. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. What they do here is they start to mockingly lead Jesus through the ascension that a king would go through once he was going to his throne. Purple robe. It is purple. That is a significant term, that it is purple. That is the color of royalty. They're saying, "Oh, mighty king, come to your throne. Here is the purple robe that belongs to you." Oh, and you know, all kings, they also have a crown. Crowns stand for victory. Oh, you're victorious. We'll twist you a crown made of thorns, to have a little bit of irony in this. You'll see in Mark chapter 15, verse 19, that they're also he's going to have a rod or a scepter of some sort. Matthew 27 also brings this up as well. They say, well, you know, not only are you the royalty that has got victory, symbolized by the crown, but you also have a rod, which symbolizes your sovereignty, because you're the king. Oh, you're the magnificent king. You're the emperor of the world. I mean, look at you. How magnificent you truly are. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again, they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. It's kind of interesting that the Romans despised the Jews so much. And yet, the trial before the Romans ends the same way that the trial before the Jews ends. With violence. Their kingdoms, even though they hate each other, they're still governed by the same things. For they only have one way of responding to this peaceful king of the Jews. Beat him. Spit on him. Mock him. Repeatedly beat him. Why? What else do you do? Taylor. Right. Where did this come from? Several different possibilities. It would not have been likely for any disciple to have access to this room. No. The only two possibilities then of where we get this information is, number one, the resurrected Jesus. It is possible that Jesus did it. That is, it is historically possible. It's not necessary, but it's possible. The second one is converted soldiers. We will see a converted soldier at some point here at the end of Mark, whenever he stands before the cross and he says, "Surely this is the Son of God." So it is possible that even after this, people that convert, you know, Cornelius in chapter 10 of Acts, things of that nature, some of them may have been on the inside of the praetorium at this moment. So one, we don't know exactly where it comes from, but it could have been either way. Good question. Again and again, they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. That's something right there that just, you know, kind of devotional moment, I guess. It really bothers me when people talk about, and I think I've said this before in here, when people talk about Jesus as just like their homeboy, it really bothers me. Man, it bothers me. You know, that shirt, "Jesus is my homeboy," that is for me borderline blasphemous. I can't stand that. Or people, you know, talk about, whenever I get to heaven, I'm going to get up there and slap Jesus on the back and give him a hug, and we're going to go. And I'm just like, man, even when they were mocking him, at least they had the right position. You bury your face in the sand. For me, it is. Jesus says, you know, in John chapter 15, that we're his friends. Yeah, you let him call you your friend, and you call him king. You see my point there? He is not your homeboy. You may be his, but he is not yours. He is your king. And even the mockers understand that. Kind of reminds me of James 2 a bit. You know, Jesus' brother writing. The demons even believe, and at least they shudder. You believe and don't do anything. He's not your homeboy. He's your king. Treat him like it. When they mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on. Then they led him out to crucify him. Why'd they do that? Why'd they do that? Why'd they go through a costume change? Yeah. Huh. Because the Roman soldiers understand politics too. You can't take him out before the Jews that just a couple days earlier were yelling out Hosanna. And with King of the Jews, have him totally decked out in mockery. You take him to the praetorium for a reason. To hide what you want to do. Do it, then come out, and they realize, oh, he was beaten, but they don't know how. Because when they're mocking Jesus, they're not just mocking Jesus, they're mocking the entire nation of the Jews. These are the Romans, the ones that rule the world, the ones that the Jews and them have been in conflict for decades upon decades. So they do a costume change, then we'll bring him out to the public and crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. A couple of things about this. Number one, what do you notice is significant about the way in which they introduced this character out of nowhere? What is significant? They say where he's from. What else do they say? What's that? Who he's the father of. Yes, like they know him. What is interesting is that Alexander and Rufus, those two names, never appear together again throughout the entire New Testament. And they're just thrown in here like, you know, Simon, you know, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way. What does that make you think? Romans. Say it again.
Are they Romans? Like, you know,
the guy,
isn't Rufus in Romans somewhere?
Rufus is mentioned in Romans. As a matter of fact, Paul says in Romans chapter 16, verse 13, greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother, who has been a mother to me too. Okay, now why is that significant? Piece all this together. Why is that significant?
Who's Mark?
Say it again.
Who is Mark writing to?
Yeah, who is Mark writing his gospel to? Go all the way back to the very first couple weeks of the semester. Who is the audience of Mark's gospel? Christians in Rome, right? More than likely, the reason why he just throws this name in is because Alexander and Rufus may have been key leaders in the churches of Rome that he was writing to. So he doesn't need to go on and further explanation of who Alexander and Rufus are, because if they're the leader of the churches he's writing to, it makes sense just to throw out their names. It'd be kind of like saying, this guy or this girl, you know, who is the father of Mark Moore? You don't need to keep going. Say, you know, Mark Moore, who has been a professor of da-da-da-da. You don't need to do that. Why? Because in our context, we know who it is. Throw out the name and move on. Whenever you see Paul talking about a Rufus in Rome, in his epistle to the Romans, you can probably put it together that this is talking about the same people. Alexander and Rufus was passing by on his way in the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. The key important understanding of the symbol of the cross in Roman context is that the cross purpose was not just to be brutal for the sake of being brutal. It was not just to inflict pain for the sake of inflicting pain. The purpose of the cross was to send a psychological message through physiological actions. You are telling everyone around you, we are in control. We are the rulers of the world. We are the sovereigns. We are the dominant. And if you have a problem with that, just look at what your fate will be by staring at the cross. You want to go up there? Then shut your mouth and obey. That's what the cross says to the Romans. It's not just a message to the ones hanging on the cross or those that follow the ones hanging on the cross. It's also a message to all of the innocent bystanders and onlookers alike. For they can walk, as someone is carrying a cross, they can walk by somebody that is innocently just passing through the country and say, it's your turn to carry this cross. But I didn't do anything. That doesn't matter. I am a Roman. I rule the world. You shut your mouth and carry his cross, or I'll make one for you too. The cross is about power. The cross is the Romans' way of exerting their dominance. And if anyone questions it, all they need to do is stand by for the next 2 or 3 days and watch what happens to someone that questions the power of Rome. Simon was just an innocent bystander. He's walking by, passing through the country. And they say, you, because we own you too, get over here and carry the cross. Verse 22, they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. What is the wine mixed with myrrh? We don't know exactly. It could be one of two things. Number one, it could be some sort of narcotic or an antiseptic that deadened his senses that possibly could have made the pain less excruciating. Or number two, it could have been some sort of poison that would help him die quicker, or maybe to put him into a lethargic state where he was experiencing but not really experiencing what he was experiencing. Does that make sense? Can I say experiencing one more time? Sure I can. Experiencing it. But he doesn't take it. Why? Because the emphasis on this chapter, especially or on this scene, is Jesus' complete reliance on God. Do not use this verse as a justification for you not giving your child, your spouse, or yourself medicine when you're going through difficult things. That's not what this verse is being used for. That makes sense? People will take verses out of context and make them do ridiculous things. This is not a biblical mandate that you're not to have any sort of antiseptics when you go under the knife, you know, to have an appendectomy. That's not the same. And they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, stop. What do you know that? What did you just notice there? What's that? That they definitely take, that he's probably naked at this point. That is probably true. What else, though, do you notice? Yeah, that's strange. It will sound a lot like Psalm 22, and we'll get there in a minute. What's striking to me is we've been building up to the crucifixion for 15 chapters. And we get there, and Mark says, and they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, it's a bit anticlimactic. Why? Because literally, Mark wants to point us to an Old Testament passage and wants to make sure we get that point, that the events surrounding Jesus' crucifixion are actually, in Mark's gospel, more important than the crucifixion itself. Because the events surrounding the crucifixion point to who Jesus is. And if you know who he is, you'll know what he accomplished. So he says, oh yeah, and they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. There are clues here that point to the passage, the Old Testament passage, Psalm 22, that Jesus will quote in verse 34. But there are clues. He does not tell us Psalm 22. He just throws in random clues, and he wants you to keep it ringing in your ears. The first one is this. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. Keep that in mind. Let's keep reading. It was the third hour when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, notice. It is the written charge why he was crucified. The reason why he hangs on a tree is put above his head. And what is that? King of the Jews. It's kingdom. Jesus was looked at, even if he was nonviolent, he was looked at politically. And what he was saying was politically explosive enough where the crowds convinced Rome that this was a good idea to preserve their own power to get rid of this rabble-rouser, the king of the Jews. They crucified two robbers with him. Ugh. Strike out the word robbers. I mean, literally, just cross it off if that's what your translation says. That is not what the word is. It is not, they don't crucify petty thieves. It's not like this guy, you know, gets caught, goes stealing a piece of bread, and they're like, crucify him. No, you don't crucify a robber. The word is laistes, and this is the third time we've seen it. First time we saw was in Mark chapter 11 when Jesus walks into the temple for the second time and he looks around and he says, you've turned my father's house into a den of laistes, into a citadel, a fortress for political revolutionaries. The second time it was used is in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus, in Mark 14, when Jesus says, am I leading a laestes, a rebellion, a political revolution that you've come out here with swords and clubs? And this is the third time. Jesus crucified in between two laestes. They are not robbers. They are political revolutionaries, insurrectionists, guerrilla warriors, people like Barabbas that have murdered in order to get their political message moved forward. He is crucified. They crucify two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. Ooh, what does that language remind you of? Say it again. Mark chapter 10. What is in Mark chapter 10? Yes, John and James ask the question, Jesus, will you answer anything that we ask of you? Or will you give us anything we request of you? And Jesus says, well, I mean, we'll see. Please, please, when you come into your glory, that's what they say, when you come into your glory, will one of us be on your right and one on your left? And Jesus says, first of all, well, he asked them a couple questions, but his main point was, the ones on my right and the one on the left when I come into glory is not for me to grant, it's for God alone to grant. It's not my call. And you have Mark here say, you have two laestes, one on the right and one on the left. A couple of different things. Historically, what you can say is, more than likely, the center cross that Jesus will occupy was probably reserved for the leader of these two laestes by the name of Barabbas. Barabbas is referred to in Matthew's gospel as the notorious leader of these insurrectionists. And the notorious leader would probably get the place of prominence, the center cross, whenever a message was going to be sent to these political insurrectionists. Jesus literally takes the place of Barabbas on the cross. And you can see the spiritual implications of him taking the place of you as well. Those of us who through our sin and through our rebellion are addicted to the things of this world, like Barabbas was, fighting for our own power and prestige through the ways of the world instead of through the way in which Jesus brought us. Number two, the fact on the right or the left also tells us what it means for Jesus to come into his glory. That his throne is a cross. That the method of his living and advancing of a kingdom is a cross. That you cannot get to how we advance the kingdom ethically without going through a cross. The sermons yesterday were dead on. The old and the new, Rome and Bethlehem. You want to know how to get to Rome? You got to have a cross. Got to. Why? Because that's what Jesus did. Cross. So what does it look like for Jesus to come to his glory? Well, it looks like him hanging on a cross with two political revolutionaries on his right and his left. That's what it looks like. Oh man. Yeah, I am going to go back because I think this is such a cool point. Verse 21, I found it a little bit ironic. Sorry, this is totally out of place. It just came to my mind. I find it ironic and very important also to note that the name of the person carrying the cross is specifically mentioned. And his name is Simon. I find that ironic because this Simon didn't ever commit to being a part of Jesus, and yet he's carrying the cross with Jesus all the way up to Golgotha, where the one Simon that committed he'd be there to the death is nowhere to be found. I find that very intriguing. Sorry, I forgot that. Keep moving. Verse, where are we at? 27, they crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads. That is another clue of the Old Testament passage that Mark is basing this entire account after. That's another clue. Keep that in mind. Hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, so, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it up into 3 days. There it is again. Come down from the cross and save yourself. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. Oh, he saved others, they said, but he can't even save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. You've wanted us to believe the whole time, Jesus. The whole time, everything you've been doing for other people, you were doing that so that we would believe. Well, now we'll tell you how we'll believe. Come down from the cross. You come down from the cross, we're yours. You want us to believe, all the Jewish elite, all you got to do is just come down to the cross. Save yourself, Jesus, save yourself. Oh, who does that sound like? Satan. Hello? Jesus will believe you if you have a kingdom without a cross. Come down from it. The one sign that you can give us for us to believe, ironically, would be the one sign that would change Jesus and his kingdom to the point where what they're believing in is not what he came to establish. All you need to do is come down and we'll believe. And Jesus says, I know who's talking to me, because this is the third or fourth time we've had an interaction in this gospel narrative. Not just in Mark 1, not just in Mark 8, not just in Mark 14. In Mark 15, Satan is lurking, saying, have a kingdom without a cross. Do it my way, Jesus, and the whole world will bow down to you. Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. What is this showing? Complete and absolute abandonment. For his disciples are not there. For the crowds are not there. The Jewish elite are not there. Even the ones being crucified with him have abandoned him. They're heaping insults on him. Verse 33. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. Why? Because any time that you have any sort of political upheaval, it's going to affect the cosmos. We talked about this in Mark 13. Why is it that the moon turning blood red and the sky being darkened and stars falling is always the type of apocalyptic language that comes with political upheaval? Because both figuratively and I think literally here, if the gods are the ones that rule the celestial bodies both in heaven and on earth, if the gods are the ones that control the way in which the stars move as well as the way in which the kings move, then whenever a political change happens on the earth, something cosmically is also happening. Therefore, the fact that the sun goes black is significant, number one, because literally that happening would catch people's attention. But figuratively, he's saying something political is happening. There is a shift in powers in this moment. And ironically, it's coming through suffering. And at the ninth hour, so am I saying that historically that didn't happen? No. But what I'm saying is don't miss the symbolic implications of what happened historically. It's a political upheaval. It's a change in the cosmos. A new creation is occurring where what once was giving us light now is dark. But one day the light will dawn again, but it'll be a brand new creation. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus' only words on the cross quotes a passage that Mark has been alluding to this whole time. And what we often misunderstand with this passage is we believe, now hear me very clearly, because this is maybe going to challenge some of the things that you've held near and dear to your heart about this moment. We believe that in this moment, when Jesus says this, that Jesus is saying that God has abandoned him on the cross. That in Jesus' darkest moment, the one that he has been relying on the whole time has left him. My God, why have you forsaken me? And I'm going to say, that is not true. God did not abandon Jesus on the cross. What Jesus is doing here is singing his favorite hymn. Matter of fact, this may even have been of him that Jesus and his daddy would have been singing while he was teaching him the trades of being a carpenter. And then it's Psalm 22. It's written by David, which is probably somewhat significant at this moment. Psalm 22, verse 1. I'm going to read this whole psalm because you'll understand why I am concluding that God is not abandoning Jesus based on this psalm that Jesus is singing and that Mark has been alluding to. It starts off, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you don't answer. By night, but you're silent. Verse 3. And yet, you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the praise of Israel. In you our fathers put their trust. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried out to you and were saved. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. The psalm begins by Jesus or by David or Jesus saying, It looks like you've totally abandoned me. It looks like absolutely everything around me has fallen apart. You're nowhere to be found. Where are you? And then he says, and yet, I'll trust you. Even when everything looks like it's falling down around me, I will trust you. Why? Because my father's fathers trusted you and they were delivered. Because everyone that I know, my great cloud of witnesses, has always trusted you and you delivered. And he goes on, he starts saying the same thing in verse 6. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by men and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. Hello? Remember the clues I told you to remember? He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him, they say. Hello? Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Sounds like we're at the foot of the cross. Verse 9, and yet, you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast upon you. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near, and there is no one to help. The psalm begins by saying, you've abandoned me, and it says, and yet I will trust you. Then it picks up in verse 6, and he says, it feels like I'm totally abandoned, and yet I will trust you. Pick it up in verse 15. This sounds really familiar. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I mean, I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. I'm still in Psalm 22, I promise. But you, O Lord, be not far off. Oh, my strength, come quickly to help me. Deliver my life from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dogs. Rescue me from the mouth of the lions. Save me from the horns of the wild oxen. I almost hear, I want to insert here, save me from the jaws of the dragon. Verse 22, I will declare your name to my brothers. I will declare your name to my brothers. But I thought he abandoned you. Now you just don't have the eyes to see. I will declare your name to my brothers. In the congregation, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, honor him. Revere him, all of you descendants of Israel. For he has not despised or disdained the suffering of the afflicted one. Did you hear that? Verse 24, for he has not despised or disdained the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. Jesus is hanging on the cross. And he starts singing one of his favorite songs. And they couldn't understand what he's saying. Oh, they're in a minute, they're going to say, he's calling for Elijah. And Jesus says, you're not listening to the song. Because if you knew what song I was singing, you would know it's happening right here. And I'm telling you, there'll be moments in your life when you feel like that everyone around you has abandoned you. You'll feel like that God himself cannot be found. But you will never feel that abandonment, that temptation of abandonment, more clearly than what Jesus could have felt on the cross. And in that moment, you start singing Psalm 22. For I don't care what the world looks like around me. I don't care if everything looks like it's crashing down on me. I don't care if it looks like that God himself has left me. I know who he is, and he always delivers. I will trust in him. Why? Because my father's father trusted in him. And those before me, my great cloud of witnesses, have always relied on him, and he's never failed them. Even whenever my hands are pierced and my feet are pierced, even whenever my clothes are divided like garments, even whenever everyone around me is shaking their heads and hurling insults, I know he is God and he will deliver. That's why I love the way that this psalm ends. Because I think when Jesus is singing the first verse, he's wanting us to get to the last verse. And this psalm ends like this. Verse 29, all the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him. Those who cannot even keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about his Lord. Listen to this. They will proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, for he has done it. On the cross, what looks like abandonment is actually victory. What looks like defeat is how our kingdom wins. Love you guys. See you in the morning.